From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new Republican-led Congress convened today. One of the priorities on the Republican agenda is overhauling the welfare system. On today's Fresh Air, we examine the welfare debate with Jason DeParo. He covers anti-poverty policy for the New York Times. Also today, we remember soul singer Ted Hawkins. After years of singing on the boardwalk in Venice, California, he released his first album on a major label earlier this year. He died New Year's Day of a stroke at the age of 58. We'll feature a recent interview. And David Bianculli previews two shows that premiere tonight, Double Rush, starring Robert Pastorelli, who played Eldon on Murphy Brown, and Women of the House, starring Delta Burke of Designing Women fame. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Georgia Republican Newt Gingrich has assumed the Speaker's chair in the House of Representatives. He's the first person from his party to do so in 40 years. The new Speaker is urging his colleagues to take up business immediately. He's reminded the representatives of the GOP's contract with America. That's a list of legislative goals the Republicans want to pass in the first 100 days of the session. Gingrich carries a list of the contract. He read the 10 items on the list in his opening address.
A balanced budget amendment and line item veto to stop violent criminals, emphasizing, among other things, an effective enforceable death penalty. Third was welfare reform. Fourth was protecting our kids. Fifth was tax cuts for families. Sixth was a stronger national defense. Seventh was raising the senior citizens' earning limit. Eighth was rolling back government regulations. Ninth was common sense legal reform. And 10th was congressional term limits. Now, our commitment on our side, and I think we have this absolute obligation, is first of all to work today till we're done. And that, I know, is going to inconvenience people who have families and supporters, but we were hired to do a job, and we have to start today to prove we'll do it.
34 U.S. senators have also taken the oath of office today, administered by Vice President Al Gore. 11 of them are freshmen. The other 66 are in the middle of their six-year terms and did not need to swear a new oath. New Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole says it's a new day in Congress. Defense lawyers for O.J. Simpson say they're dropping their challenge to admitting genetic evidence at trial. The move was a surprise. It means there will be only a scaled-back hearing on the critical evidence. The judge in the case has also proposed the jury be sequestered as of January 11th. The trial is expected to last for at least 3 months. The French government has criticized Russia for using violence in the separatist Republic of Chechnya. France wants the European Union to play a role in ending the conflict there. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
When Russian tanks first rolled into the breakaway republic, France and other Western countries turned a blind eye to the bloodshed. They said it was an internal Russian affair. But now, Foreign Minister Alain Juppé says the West has a right to demand explanations from Russia. He said Moscow had promised last month at a meeting of the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe to follow certain rules in maintaining order. When you want to be a real partner, Juppé said, you must be open and negotiate, not use violence. Juppé said France, which currently chairs the rotating presidency of the European Union, will propose an initiative to end the conflict. Other European countries have also criticized Russia's use of force in the Republic. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen more than 15 points to 3,854. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is up more than a point at 744. This is NPR. A federal grand jury has indicted John Salvi in the shootings at two abortion clinics in Massachusetts. The indictments allege Salvi carried a firearm across state lines with intent to commit a felony. He's already facing charges in Massachusetts and Virginia. Each of the two federal counts carries a top penalty of 10 years in prison and a fine of $250,000. The federal prosecutor in Boston says Salvi will appear in federal court in Norfolk, Virginia, and at that time, prosecutors will ask that he be extradited to Massachusetts. There are new immigration rules for those who seek asylum in the United States. The guidelines, which take effect today, come along with a surge in asylum seekers. NPR's Melinda Penkava reports.
In the past 2 years, more than 300,000 people arrived in the U.S. claiming they would face persecution if they returned to their homelands. The Immigration Service estimates it has 425,000 such cases yet to process. INS blames the backlog in part on those who abuse the current system. It allows anyone seeking asylum to enter the U.S. and immediately begin to work while they wait what turns out to be years for their hearing. To dissuade those who claim asylum only to work in the U.S., the INS is making a change. It will not grant working papers until an asylum seeker has been in the U.S. for 6 months. INS is hoping to have future cases decided within that time, and toward that end, it is doubling the number of staffers and hearing judges to chip away at the backlog. I'm Melinda Pencava in Washington.
The Bridgestone Firestone Tire Company says it's replacing strikers at plants in four states. The Tennessee-based firm is replacing some 2,000 striking workers. Affected plants are in Illinois, Iowa, Oklahoma, and Indiana. The company and the United Rubber Workers Union have been without a contract since April. About 4,200 workers walked off their jobs July 12th. The company says after a long strike, plants must start 7 days a week operation. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new Republican-led Congress convened today. High on the Republican agenda is overhauling the welfare system. During Bill Clinton's presidential campaign, he pledged to end welfare as we know it. Last summer, he presented a plan that would provide more job training for welfare recipients and require those who remained on welfare after 2 years to join a work program. But the new Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, says the Clinton plan doesn't go far enough. Gingrich has his own, more restrictive plan, known as the Personal Responsibility Act. My guest, Jason DeParle, covers anti-poverty policy for the New York Times. We asked him to bring us up to date on the welfare debate. Let's start with the provisions of the Personal Responsibility Act.
There's two sets of ideas in the Republican camp about what to do about welfare. One is to put welfare recipients to work, and there are work provisions in there. After 2 years, you have to go into a work program. You could stay in the work program for a few more years, and if you still hadn't found a job at the end of that, you'd be left with neither work nor welfare. So that's the work camp. There's a second camp in the Republican Party, which often is dubbed the illegitimacy camp, and that group of people says the problem isn't putting, the challenge isn't to put welfare recipients to work, it's to keep them from having children outside of marriage in the first place. The way they propose to do that is by denying all benefits to mothers of children who are born out of wedlock under a certain age. Different proposals have different age. I think in the Personal Responsibility Act, it would be anyone under 18 would be ineligible for benefits. At a state option, they could raise that up to 21. And that's for the lifetime of the mother. So if you're a 19-year-old woman, you have a child out of wedlock, it doesn't mean you have to wait until you're 21 to collect welfare benefits. It means that neither you nor that child could collect benefits for the rest of your life. All the talk about orphanages that the public has probably heard has come out of that part of the provision. What do you do about those families, about mothers who have children and are now ineligible for any kind of benefits?
So under the Republican plan, you only get 2 years of welfare for a lifetime?
You get 2 years, right, 2 years of AFDC followed by some eligibility for a work program. It's up to the states how long you could stay in. I think a maximum of 5 years, a minimum of 1 year. So it's possible that after 2 years on AFDC, 1 year in the work program, after so it's a lifetime total of 3 years, you could be out on the streets.
And you could never be eligible again?
That's right. Under the Clinton plan, there were a complicated calculus for earn back provisions that if you worked so many months, you could bank so many months of public assistance credit again. I don't believe that's in the Republican plan.
I think the part of the Republican welfare plan that has gotten the most attention has to do with cutting off money for children of teenage mothers and creating more orphanages. Do the architects believe that this will discourage girls from getting pregnant?
Well, that yes. Yes, they do. That's the hope, that without the abolition of AFDC would bring a marked reduction in the out-of-wedlock birth rate among young women.
Have there been studies that offer any evidence to back that up?
It gets very technical. They've been debating this back and forth for 10 years, looking at, there's a lot of natural variation in the welfare benefits between one state and another. Mississippi pays a mother with two children something in the neighborhood of $150 a month, where California pays somewhere around $630 a month. Those aren't precise figures, but that's the idea. So social scientists have tried to look at the economic incentives and by comparing people in one state to another. I think there's been shown to be some slight difference in the birth rate linked to the amount of the benefit, but curiously only for whites, not for blacks. I'm not sure what the explanation of that is supposed to be. Perhaps there's cultural factors that override the economic factors. But there's slim evidence that changing the benefit level could make some minor difference. I don't think there's any evidence that it would make a huge difference, although intuitively it would suggest that it would. If you simply abolished all AFDC, you would expect there be some reduction in the birth rate, if nothing else, through an increase in abortions. The question is how much and at what cost. Even if you cut it by half, what happens to the other half of people? And there's no particular evidence that it would fall by as much as a half.
How exactly do orphanages figure into the Republican plan?
I think that's an issue that's been largely misunderstood. There's two debates about orphanages. One is whether for children who have already been taken away from their parents because of abuse and neglect, is some sort of congregate setting like a group home a better solution than the foster care system as it currently exists. That's not really, and that's an issue that people of goodwill disagree on all sides, and there's a debate among even within the liberal community about whether a congregate setting is better than the foster care system. The issue isn't really orphanages. The issue raised by the Republican plan isn't really orphanages. It's whether the society is willing to create orphans, and that's a crucial distinction, I think. Under the Republican plan, some children would be taken away from their families for no other reason than indigence. It's not that their mothers would neglect them or abuse them. It's that their mothers don't have any money. If they had AFDC, they could afford somehow to keep the family together. Without AFDC, they'd be rendered completely indigent, and the children would have to be taken away under some circumstances. That's the difference.
Would you say the Republican proposal is more about changing behavior or saving money?
Well, that's a good question. I'd say it's more about changing behavior, but it's the product of a compromise between different camps with different agendas. I think the people who've been most involved historically, people like Santorum, Representative Clay Shaw, I'd probably even say Gingrich, care more, talk more about changing behavior. But I think there's a lot of other people who see it as an opportunity simply to save money. I don't think it'll prove to be that. I think that one of the least understood things about the AFDC system is about the cheapest solution. I mean, at least in the short term, unless you buy the idea that you're going to have radical changes in behavior as a result and everyone's going to become middle class simply by dint of their improved character, it's much cheaper to send a mother a welfare check and have her stay at home than it is either to put her to work or to house her children in some alternative setting.
You did a recent New York Times Magazine cover story on a woman who's going to extremes in order to stay off welfare. Her name is Marianne Moore. She lives in the Cabrini Green Housing Project in Chicago. She works at a kitchen for the Salvation Army. Tell us what her morning schedule is like in order for her to get to work and to get her kids off to school.
Well, she grew up in Cabrini Green. She's not living there now. And in fact, that's part of the problem because Cabrini Green's in the center of downtown Chicago. Marianne lives in a subsidized apartment in the South Shore of Chicago, about 10 miles south of the city core, south of Cabrini. She has to get up at 3:30 in the morning to get to work by 6. She has 4 kids. She has a 14-year-old, a 5-year-old, and two-year-old twins. So she's up at 3:30. She leaves the house at 5, takes the kids to Cabrini Green, drops them off with her mother there at about 5:30, and then drives another half hour north to get to the shelter by 6. The kids then have to have a pretty difficult day. They get to the grandmother's house at 5:30 and wait till about 7:30 when the 14-year-old takes the 5-year-old to his Head Start program. The two of them get on a city bus together, and then Marcello, the 14-year-old, goes on the eighth grade, comes back at the end of his day, picks up his little brother at Head Start, and goes back to Cabrini Green to wait for his mother. The two-year-old twins stay at the housing project with Marianne's mother or her sister, and Marianne goes on and spends the day at a Salvation Army shelter where she cooks meals for about 100 people.
You did the math, taking her salary, then deducting the expenses, you know, what it costs her just to go to work. Do you remember what the figures were and how that compares to what she'd be making from welfare?
Well, Marianne actually makes more money than most people who come off AFD could expect to make. She was making $8 an hour, plus she's getting a lot of overtime. On the weekends, she works 2 days in a row, 13-hour shifts, so she's at the shelter at 6 in the morning and doesn't leave until 7 at night, and she's getting time and a half, so those are $12 an hour time that she puts in. Even with all that, however, she's little, if any, better off than she would be on AFTC. She has her income with all that would be about $1,645 after taxes. But there's a lot she has to subtract out of that. Her transportation is about $400 a month. Her child care is about $100 a month. She has to pay a student loan payment. Her rent went up. When you net it all out, it comes to about $775 a month. We figured out how much she would make if she simply was on AFDC and food stamps, and she'd be about $200 a month better off. I think it's important to remember, though, when people hear figures like that, they often think the solution is to cut AFDC. But AFDC has been cut substantially in the past 2 decades. Its value, inflation, when adjusted for inflation, has eroded by about 40%. There's a fascinating study by a Rutgers sociologist named Catherine Eden who tried to figure out how a mother with 2 children can live on benefits that average $380 a month, and she found basically that they can't. Virtually every AFDC mother she studied had some sort of unreported income, either through a part-time job that she hadn't reported or through a boyfriend or a relative. You simply can't live on what welfare provides. But frequently you can't live on what work provides either. You're caught between two unpalatable options there.
My guest is Jason DeParle. He covers anti-poverty policy for the New York Times. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're discussing the current welfare debate with Jason DeParle. He covers anti-poverty policy for the New York Times. Last month, his profile of Marianne Moore was on the cover of the Times magazine. She's struggling to keep her job and stay off welfare. Now, you said that Marianne Moore held about 11 jobs in 5 years. Why so many jobs? And is that at all typical of people who have been on welfare and are trying to get back to work?
It's very typical. About 70% of the women who come on to welfare for the first time will leave within 2 years. But the problem is that two-thirds of them or so will eventually return. They find that they simply can't find a palatable alternative to AFDC. It's kind of you can't live with it and you can't live without it. The problem is that most of the jobs that these women can qualify for pay little. Often don't provide health insurance, so a lot of time Marianne at times has quit in order to get her children medical care, because if she goes back on AFDC, she qualifies for Medicaid. That's been a big problem for many, many people. In fact, the original Clinton plan was predicated on the notion that you had to do health care first. That's one of the reasons why they pushed for health care before they pushed for welfare reform, because without universal coverage, many of these women will become worse off by leaving AFDC to take a job. And there's a variety of other factors. Child care, what do you do with the kids? And her own, those are the sort of structural problems that liberals will often point to. They say that wages aren't high enough, there isn't enough child care, there isn't enough health care. A host of other factors come into play, the ones that conservatives are more likely to point to. A lot of these women don't have the social skills that you need to maintain a job. They get in they have problems getting there on time. They get into fights with coworkers or their supervisors. These jobs are not very appealing. One of Marianne's jobs was guarding a parking lot in the Chicago winter. They're often boring, difficult, harsh, repetitive, and they get discouraged.
How do you think a conservative and a liberal would offer different interpretations of the meaning of Marianne Moore's story and the lesson we should take away from her story to understand the larger welfare system?
One of the things that was striking to me about Marianne is she could serve as a Rorschach test or a mirror for, you could read into her experience almost any lesson you wanted to. She certainly fits the liberal diagnosis that the problem isn't welfare, but the problem is poverty, meaning that she doesn't have the education. There's no place for her in the economy. She can't earn enough to support her family. She's left without health care when she goes to work. She doesn't have reliable transportation. She doesn't have reliable child care. They would say that the solution to Marianne's problem would be to provide better job training, to provide more child care, to provide universal health care, to expand wage supplementation programs like tax credits, that the problem is in the economics of it. You need to bolster her earnings capacity and make it easier for her to go to work. I think a lot of that's true. The conservative diagnosis there would be that her problems exist with her own motivation and her own behavioral patterns. And she herself often points the finger at herself. I think there's a lot of that is true as well. She had children out of wedlock beginning at age 19. She developed a drug problem, which caused her to lose a number of jobs. She was a cocaine addict for a while. She went into rehabilitation, has been clean for a couple of years. She herself sometimes says that she gets discouraged and she's quit jobs simply because she lacked the motivation to stick with them. You could read into her experience of being in and out of 11 jobs over 5 years to support basically whatever set of theories you come to the situation with. I think it's both sets of diagnoses are true. What was most striking to me about her life is that it didn't get any better when she went to work. She didn't grow up on AFDC, but she did grow up in poverty. Her mother lived in the Cabrini-Green Housing Project. She was surrounded by extreme violence growing up. She was 8 years old when the first time she saw someone killed. Her son was 7 years old the first time he saw someone killed. And when she went to work, whether she was working or she wasn't working, she was still living in a very poor, very violent neighborhood, and she saw little economic gain. The math always came out to about the same. I came away from that thinking that the real problem in her life all along had been poverty and violence rather than the rules of the welfare system.
What are her concerns about changes in the welfare system, even though she's not on welfare now and I'm sure hopes not to be on it again?
I think her main concern is whether there'll be something for her to fall back on when these interruptions come up. She got sick right after. I stayed with her for a couple of weeks in late October, early November. She got sick right as I was leaving and ended up missing 7 days of work. The twins got a stomach flu. In fact, I caught it while I was there, and I was out down with it for about a day and back up the next day feeling fine. Marianne, it knocked her out for 7 days. She was just so weak from getting up at 3:30 in the morning constantly and so worn out. She didn't have sick days for that, so she lost that pay. Her car kept breaking down while I was there. She spent $500 to repair it, and it broke down 10 days later. When you get immersed in her life, you feel how fragile her hold on the employment was, that she couldn't get to work without the car. She couldn't get to work when she was sick. The child care always threatened to break down when her mother was having problems or going out of town or any number of things constantly threatened to come up and keep her from getting to work. And her fear is that if that happens, that her concern is that there'd be something, some safety net to catch the family. She's been homeless before, and I think homelessness is a real tangible prospect for her, that if she loses a job and she can't go back to AFDC, that's where she would end up.
Jason DePaola is my guest, and he covers anti-poverty policy for the New York Times. You know, the two of the really big issues on the agenda are welfare and crime. What kind of connections do liberals and conservatives make between welfare and crime, or poverty and crime?
I'm glad you asked that, because we've been talking about behavior, and that's certainly the way the Republicans want to define the welfare issue, that the welfare issue is one of character, it's one of behavior. An alternative hypothesis is that the welfare issue is really one of poverty. I think the public assumes that welfare is, when they talk about welfare, they assume, they use it as a proxy for a lot of other things they don't like in society, like educational failure, crime, out-of-wedlock birth, poverty, violence, all the things that Americans are naturally and understandably concerned about in society, that gets bundled up and it's called welfare. And the tacit assumption is that if you cut welfare, those other problems are going to go away. It's quite possible those other problems will only get worse, things like crime, violence, and poverty. It really depends how you define the problem. Is welfare the problem, or is welfare... I came away from my time with Miriam Moore thinking that the real problems in her life had been poverty and violence, and that welfare had not particularly helped her and not particularly hurt her. It was a sort of neutral factor on the sidelines.
How soon do the congressional hearings on welfare begin?
Next week, right away.
And what do you think the chances are of the Republican bill passing?
In its current, by the Republican bill, if you mean the Gingrich proposal, in its current form, I would say it has a good chance of passing the House. I would expect it to be modified substantially when it gets to the Senate. But no one knows for sure. I mean, one of the interesting things about the welfare debate is how fast and far it's changed in the past couple of years. When Clinton was first talking about his own proposal to impose a two-year time limit and then enroll people in community service, the conventional wisdom was that he would never go forward with something like that. It would be riddled with loopholes. It would sound tough, but in reality, never quite live up to it. In fact, he did live up to it. He produced something even tougher than he had pledged, and it's been dismissed as far too tepid and mild. So anyone laying bets over the past few years on how far and how strict and how stringent the welfare debate would come, you couldn't be wrong by overestimating how far and fast it would go to the right.
Why do you think that's happened?
It's happened for two sets of reasons. One, the welfare system doesn't work, and there's lots of legitimate cause for concern. The out-of-wedlock birth rate is at record highs. The welfare rolls are at record highs. The system doesn't work, and anyone looking at problems to fix in America would want to start with that toward the top of the list. But it's also happened for less appealing or less noble reasons. I think when people... The unspoken agenda often, not always, often, is a racial one. I think when people think about welfare, they often think of minorities, particularly blacks. And politicians have found it expedient and to their advantage to use welfare. And it evokes a lot of unspoken agendas as well, I think.
Well, Jason DePaola, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jason DePaola covers anti-poverty policy for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Random House, publisher of The Paperboy, the new novel from Paris Trout author Pete Dexter. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we remember soul singer Ted Hawkins. For years, he sang on the boardwalk of Venice, California. After recording several albums on independent labels, his first major label recording was released earlier this year. As he was reaching new audiences and beginning a new level of commercial success, he died Sunday of a stroke at the age of 58. Also, David Bianculli previews two shows that premiere tonight, Double Rush, starring Robert Pastorelli, who played Eldon on Murphy Brown, and Women of the House, starring Delta Burke of Designing Women fame. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The 104th Congress has convened, and the House of Representatives has a new speaker.
The Honorable Newt Gingrich of the state of Georgia is duly elected Speaker of the House of Representatives for the 104th Congress, having received a majority of the votes cast.
Gingrich is the first Republican to hold the post in 40 years. He is second in line to the presidency. Gingrich says he's moved.
I feel overwhelmed in every way, overwhelmed by all the Georgians who came up, overwhelmed by my extended family that is here, overwhelmed by the historic moment I walked out and stood in the balcony just outside the Speaker's office looking down the mall this morning very early, and I was just overwhelmed by the view, which two men I've introduced know very, very well. I will introduce them very, very well. And just the sense of being part of America and being part of this great tradition.
New House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt says although Democrats have lost control of the House, there are no losers in the Congress of the United States.
All across the world, from Bosnia to Chechnya to South Africa, people lay down their lives for the kind of voice we take for granted. Too often, the transfer of power is an act of pain and carnage, not one, as we see today, of peace and decency.
Democratic Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan plans to introduce a measure in the Senate that would repeal Major League Baseball's antitrust exemption, NPR's Mark Schramm reports.
Senator Moynihan's bill is called the National Pastime Preservation Act. It would repeal the exemption baseball owners have enjoyed from federal labor laws and antitrust statutes since 1922, and would permit the players to challenge the owners' labor practices in court. The current exemption prevents the players from doing that. They say their only recourse in a labor dispute is to strike, which they did last August. During congressional hearings last fall, players testified that if the exemption was lifted, they would return to the field. But Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig said the exemption has provided stability to the game. Moynihan said the game of baseball is in great peril, and that the exemption has allowed the owners to act as a cartel. Major League Baseball is the only sport with an antitrust exemption. I'm Mark Schramm in Washington.
Former Defense Secretary Dick Cheney says he won't seek the Republican presidential nomination next year. He released a short surprise announcement yesterday. He didn't give a reason for his decision, but the Associated Press is quoting an aide who says Cheney didn't want to put his family through the lengthy ordeal of the campaign. There are still several other possible contenders: former Vice President Dan Quayle, Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, former Education Secretary Lamar Alexander, former Secretary of State James Baker, former Housing Secretary Jack Kemp. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow gained more than 19 points. This is NPR News from Washington. Dr. Jack Kevorkian is taking his euthanasia case to the Supreme Court. Kevorkian's lawyer says he'll petition the high court early this year for a ruling that assisted suicide is constitutionally protected. The Michigan Supreme Court has ruled that it's a felony under state law. Kevorkian's lawyer says the U.S. Supreme Court is now the logical place to go. Kevorkian has been present at 21 deaths since 1990. The Michigan Supreme Court ruling leaves him exposed to prosecution in as many as 17 of those deaths. An area near Watertown in northern New York is being hit by a severe snowstorm. Chris Ulanowski, a member station WRVO, has this report.
The lake effect snow, which is the result of cold air moving over the warmer waters of Lake Ontario, has dumped up to 3 feet of snow in some areas. The snow squalls began early yesterday and will persist into today. Rufus Chalmers lives in Woodville in southern Jefferson County.
It's a fairly respectable accumulation, and visibility looking out the road is probably 150, 200 feet, something on that order. I have not seen a plow in several hours.
Many schools either closed for the day or delayed opening. Jefferson County authorities say the snowfall and blowing snow have created zero visibility conditions, making traveling hazardous. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Shilinowski in Oswego, New York.
American Eagle is resuming commuter airline service today from Chicago. The airline had shut down for 3 weeks because of concerns with ATR-type aircraft. The Federal Aviation Administration banned the planes from flying in icy weather 6 weeks after a fatal crash in Indiana. San Francisco quarterback Steve Young has been named the National Football League's most valuable player this season by the Associated Press. Young broke Joe Montana's team records for touchdowns and completion percentage marks this season. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last year, a performer who deserved wider recognition seemed to be getting it at last. Ted Hawkins had spent much of his career singing on the boardwalk in Venice, California, stopping passerbys with a voice reminiscent of Sam Cooke and Otis Redding. He'd been discovered and rediscovered several times. He had a couple of excellent records on the Rounder label, but he kept ending up back on the boardwalk. Last year, Geffen brought out his first major label release, and with it came tours, festival performances, and more commercial success than he'd ever had. We were very sad to learn today that Sunday Hawkins died of a stroke at the age of 58. Hawkins had a hard life. He grew up poor in Mississippi, was sent to reform school when he was 12, and later did time in prison before traveling to the West Coast and finding his spot on the boardwalk. We're going to remember him now with an interview from last year. First, let's hear a song from that Geffen CD. This is There Stands the Glass.
The glass that will ease all my pain, that will settle my brain, is my first one today. There stands the glass that will drown all my fears, that will hide all my tears. Brother, I'm on my way. I'm wondering where you are tonight. I'm wondering if you are all right. I'm wondering, do you think of me in my misery? Fill it up to the brim till my troubles grow dim. This my first one today.
Last year, Ted Hawkins told me it was tougher to sing on the boardwalk than in the studio.
On the boardwalk, I have to start singing from 10 in the morning until 6 that evening. And I got to really strain my guts out in order to stop the people. And stopping the people is not enough. You got to hold it, hold them there. And that's a job. That's two jobs. And then they're going to have to like what you're doing.
Did you have a microphone on the boardwalk?
No.
So you have to sing pretty loud, too.
Yes, and eat a lot of sand when there's a windy day.
Well, that must make it harder to sing if you open up your mouth and some sand blows in.
That's down my throat.
Did that hurt your throat?
It caused me to get a nodule.
And did you have to have that removed?
I had to have it removed here in America, but they didn't do it right because all they did was just burn it off, you know, with a laser. It looked good, but it burned off some of the membranes that I needed to sing. So I had to get it done again after I got to London.
You sing a fair amount of country music. How did you start listening to country?
I don't know exactly when, but I know that it began to grow on me because the words were so meaningful. I don't look at a song just because I want to dance and, you know, shake my rump and get all funky. I like to sit down and listen to a real good song being an adult, you know, that have meaningful words. You see, we don't have those kind of songs no more, especially a good tearjerker,
mm-hmm.
like All I Have to Offer, you know, Chris Chandeliers. That song hit me and turned me every way but loose. And I say, why don't Charlie Pride sing that a little bit more stronger? I mean, since those words are so meaningful, why don't he really, really cry those songs? Why is he just, all I have to, come on. That's a great song, man. Come on and sing, you know. And he wouldn't do it. And so I learned the song and I did it myself and it felt a whole lot better, you know, like picking meat out your teeth.
So is that one of the reasons why you'll do a song? Because you thought the first person who recorded it didn't do it justice?
Yes. You ever seen a bump on somebody's forehead that you wish you could burst? They won't go on and bust it. You know what I mean? That's the way it is with people's stuff. They don't seem to do it right. Uh-huh. Yeah. I said, why don't he scream there? That he could have easily screamed right there. Why didn't he scream?
No. What about when you sing a song that somebody who you really like recorded, like Sam Cooke or Otis Redding?
There's nothing you can say about Sam. There's no kind of alternation you can do with Sam. If you mess around with Sam Cooke's songs, you mess it up. Sam Cooke is the greatest singer in the world.
So what do you do when you do one of his songs?
I just lay back and do it, you know, and hope that I'm able to do it, you know, somewhere around the way he does it, you know, because he's a very hard-working, intense young man.
Why don't we hear Having a Party from your Boardwalk Tapes album?
And everybody's swinging. Sally's doing that twist now. If you take requests, I've got a few for you. Play that song called Soul Twist and play that one called I Know. Don't forget the mashed potatoes. No other songs will do. And let me tell you, Mr. DJ, keep those records playing, 'cause I'm having such a good time. Dancing with my baby, having a party, yeah.
That's Ted Hawkins. We'll hear more of our interview after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Ted Hawkins, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your background. I know you grew up in Mississippi. Your mother worked as a prostitute. When did you realize what that meant?
I realized what that meant when I was a child. I've seen other prostitutes, you know, walk around among other ones, you know, on the streets. And I knew what was happening, you know, while I was a child. I was fending for myself, you know.
Were you ever around when she was working?
No, I wasn't. No. I never did hang around home at all that much. I was always out, you know, trying to get something and trying to accumulate something.
How did you take care of yourself when you were very young?
I'd go down to the beach and I'd get me old crab and net, and I put some meat in the middle of tied in the middle, and let my net all the way down to the bottom, leave about a half hour, come back, and it's full of crabs when I pull it up, and I take them to the house and boil them, you know, and I eat them. I would fish. That's one thing about Biloxi. You know, you can fish and crab. You can, if you have any ambition at all, you can make it in Biloxi. I'd pick up pecans, and I knew a guy that would give me 25 cents a pound and 4 pounds, a dollar. And back in those days, a dollar was a dollar.
No, I know when you were young, you were sent to reform school in Jackson, Mississippi. How did you get in?
When I was 12 years old, I was sent there by my mother. The lady at the city hall talked her into, you know, you can't take care of him anyway. I mean, you know, you might as well send him somewhere he can get some training and some learning and perhaps some schooling. And so she did it. That was in 1949. I went there, and I learned how to work, get up and go to work, you know, rise and shine. And they gave us grits and grease and and bread and stuff like that. And the staff ate the bacon and stuff. They put the bacon grease over our grits. And we went to the fields and we hoed and picked potatoes and pulled corn and, you know, the whole bit. That taught me how to fight, you know, how to protect myself. You know, it was other boys. It was a boys' camp, nothing but just boys.
You were coming from a pretty rough life because you had to fend for yourself as a kid. Your mother wasn't really taking care of you. So did reform school seem like an improvement, or did you hate it?
It seemed like a country club.
Compared to what you were used to?
Yes, I got to eat, you know. Eating had been the big EAT right in front of me, you know, eat. That's what had been hunting me all my life. And when I got to Oakley, I was able to eat three meals a day, you know, and I was very happy there. Learning all over the campus, and just, it was a big campus, just running wild, just running, just having a good time.
Now, what about music? Were you exposed to more music there? Did you sing while you were there?
I met a guy by the name of Professor Longhair.
Oh, the great New Orleans pianist.
Yes, he would come there, and he would walk among the boys, and he would talk to the boys and stuff like that, and he'd ask me to beat the ham bone for me there. And then I'd beat the ham bone for him and pop my mouth, and he liked me. And one day he saw a bunch of children hanging around me, and I was singing for them. I can't exactly remember the song I was singing, but I'd always sing, you know, something for the kids. And he went and told Miss William. Miss William was Professor G.W. Williams' wife. That's two people who was head of that place, Oakley Training School, where I was.
Mm-hmm.
She played the piano also. She took me to the chapel, and him and her taught me a song called Somebody's Knocking at Your Door. And he played the piano, and she accompanied me. They took me to Jackson, Mississippi, put me on a stage. I was behind the curtain, and somebody called my name, you know, Ted Hawkins, and my little heart jumped in my neck, and I start trembling and shaking. My knees got weak. My legs started itching, and I didn't know which way to go. I was scared to death. I froze and didn't move. The lady behind me, Miss Williams, she gave me a push. She shoved me on out there, and I started singing and tore the house down. Everybody in the place rushed up there. You know, can you imagine a lot of people rushing up to you, you know, from the audience?
Mm-hmm.
He picked me up and turned me around and kissed me and hugged me and squeezed me and said, oh, you got such a wonderful voice. You know, that felt good to me. I liked it. And I wanted some more of that, but I didn't know how to go about getting it again.
We're featuring an interview with Ted Hawkins, who died Sunday. Let's hear his recording of Your Cheatin' Heart.
Your cheatin' heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
So how did you start singing on the boardwalk?
I was singing downtown Los Angeles. there was other people, you know, down there standing, Jehovah Witnesses and things, you know. So I thought maybe it was okay for me to sing. There was other people. Every now and then you see a guy sitting on the corner playing. But while they was doing that, the people was passing right on by. But when I started singing, the people stopped, and the crowd started backing up in the street. So the police say, what's happening down there? And they made it down there and say, hey, what? Move on. What are you doing? I said, I'm sorry. I saw everybody else singing, so I just thought I would, you know, do it too, you know. You can't, you know, you cause chaos. You move on. Pick up your stuff and go. I said, well, where can I go? And someone said, well, Ted, why don't you go to Venice Beach? I said, where is that at? They said, get the Venice bus and ride to the end of the line, and there you are on Venice Beach. I said, all right. I did that. And I was seeing all those people walking both ways, fire eaters, people standing on their head, people walking on glass. I said, what is this? And I said, oh, look at the folks. Look at the money. I said, oh, my goodness alive. I said, this is heaven on earth. And I stood there and sang. And I had a cigar box, you know, and my feet started getting tired. I said, oh, my God, I want to sit down. I ain't got nothing to sit on. And I started walking the back streets until I found a milk crate. It was in 1974. I started walking the back streets. And I took the milk crate back to the boardwalk, and I sit there, and I've been doing that ever since.
Ted Hawkins died Sunday of a stroke at the age of 58. Our interview was recorded last spring. His albums include Watch Your Step and Happy Hour on Rounder Records and The Next 100 Years on Geffen Records.
I've got big things to do. Too soon my life will be through. Got no time to stop and pick up no flowers. I've got catching up to do. Yes, I've got big things to do. Now I've got a song here to write. I stay up most every night, creating with hope they will live on forever. I've got big things to do. Yes, I've got so much to do. Got no school.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is broadcasting live from Capitol Hill tonight. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up?
Well, we're going to be hearing throughout the program about today's swearing-in of the 104th Congress, some of the pomp of the election of Newt Gingrich as Speaker of the House and the election of all the other officers, swearing-in of all the members. We'll also hear about their actions on new rules for the House of Representatives. And we've also asked a number of writers, historians, both Democrats and Republicans, to give us their appraisals of what today might amount to with the perspective of history. What'll it all look like some years hence? Also, some visitors to Capitol Hill and the prospects for lobbying reform.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight on CBS, two of TV's most successful writer-producers, Diane English of Murphy Brown and Linda Bloodworth Thomason of Designing Women, unveil new sitcoms featuring co-stars of those hits. TV critic David Bianculli has these reviews.
Both of these new shows are examples of TV détente, in which actors who walked away from their previous shows after fights with the producers have kissed and made up and been rewarded with new shows of their own. Last season, Robert Pastorelli, who played Eldon on Murphy Brown, left that show over a salary dispute. But he and Diane English made up, and she turned around and created Double Rush, a new series in which he stars as Johnny Verona, the owner of a Manhattan messenger service. The season before that, Delta Burke quit Designing Women and struck off on her own. But after last season's sitcom named Delta flopped, she and Linda Bloodworth Thomason buried the hatchet, revived Burke's Designing Women character of Suzanne Sugarbaker, and sent Suzanne to Washington as a first-term member of Congress in the new sitcom Women of the House. Linda Bloodworth Thomason is such good friends with Bill Clinton that she and husband Harry Thomason made Clinton's film biography for the 1992 Democratic Convention. She's also a funnier writer than Diane English. So you'd expect Women of the House to be the funnier of the two shows, as well as a very sharp political satire. But it isn't. Even with co-stars like Terry Garr and Valerie Mahaffey, Women of the House isn't very funny and doesn't hit any hard or new targets. And when Delta Burke, as Suzanne Sugarbaker, takes the podium to address Congress and defend her politically incorrect actions, what should be a terrific scene turns out to be a soporific.
So I guess you could say I'm a little bit different. But from what I know about history, which is not a lot, that's what being an American is all about. The right to be different, to think differently, act differently, and say different things. Kind of like Jimmy Stewart and that Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I mean, maybe you people here have forgotten what it's like to be different. To not run around in a little herd reading all the same newspapers and talking to all the same people at all the same dinner parties and trying so damn hard to impress each other. And then you book yourselves on those, what do you call those things, journalistic round tables so that you can sit around and talk about the gossip that you yourselves have been spreading. Like Mr. Smith said, if only you thought as much about being honest as you do about being smart.
Double Rush, with Pastorelli as an almost successful rock musician who runs a bicycle messenger firm, is a lot like Taxi on two wheels. Just like Corinne Borer as Zoe, an Ivy League graduate who drops in and never leaves, is a lot like Shelley Long's Diane Chambers from Cheers. But stealing from the best isn't necessarily a bad thing in TV. Not if you can find your own voice and invest your own energy. Double Rush does. The pilot isn't anything outstanding, but the characters it introduces have a lot more flair and life than the usual ones populating CBS sitcoms these days. I particularly like Sam Loyd as Barkley, the dispatcher. Where Louis De Palmer, the cab dispatcher on Taxi, was rude to everybody, Barkley is nice to everybody, whether he's dealing with a customer on the phone or with Zoe in person. Nice is good, but he's also very deliberate and slow, which in a messenger company is kind of a liability. It is, however, pretty funny.
Excuse me?
The messenger should be there any minute, sir. Time, of course, being a relative thing.
I said, excuse me?
Please hold.
I need this portfolio to get uptown right away. It's urgent. It has to be at this address in 15 minutes. My whole career depends on it.
Your whole career depends on one delivery? Now, how exactly did you let things get to this point?
I haven't been able to resolve that in 2 years with my therapist, so I doubt it will have an answer today.
Double Rush I have hopes for, although its first three episodes rank no better than slightly above average. That's a lot better, though, than the first two installments of Women of the House, which would have to improve a lot to reach average. Women of the House doesn't deliver. Double Rush does deliver, in more than one sense of the word.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.